One of my favorite tunes from the 2003 film, this one. And I love this tune for so many reasons, not the least of which is how you treat it throughout the film. Of course, the movie is Elf from 2003. One of my favorite elements of what you did throughout the entire film is this little whistling. And I remember saying that to you not so long ago. And for me, that was just like this incredibly fun icing on the cake. Let's get to that in a moment. Before we do, why don't we share this scene where Buddy the Elf is just about to finally leave for the North Pole, his adventures in New York about to begin. And the reason I wanted to share this scene with our listeners and our viewers is because I think this is a really great 90-second exercise in how you have proven yourself time and time again throughout the decades, just how versatile of a composer you really are, and certainly one of the tools that is needed to, I think, survive the variables that exist in this industry. So let's just see how quickly on a dime you change styles. I love this here very much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, buddy.
Bye, buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal. Bye.
So in just a very short amount of time, we get, you know, four very, very different styles. And if there's any, you know, argument to needing to know your craft, this certainly highlights a very legitimate argument for that. Because, you know, as you know, who's been doing this for so long, you just never know what kind of style you're going to need to tap into. And the more that you're able to tap into, the more studied you are, the more you have at your disposal. You know, perhaps Benjamin Britten, one of the best that ever did that. You know, I think you listen to Billy Budd in one of his final pieces, I mean, one of his latest operas, and you hear a lifetime of tools on his belt being employed over those 3 hours. And it's incredible. I mean, the amount of things that he throws at you between, you know, beginning and end is great. So yeah, that's why I love this little area here, because of how quickly you had to travel through style.
Well, I you know what, thank you for all that. Couple of things on that piece of music and that scene. That's one of my favorite scenes too. And by the way, that scene really and started my relationship with Jon Favreau, which has been an incredible, fruitful, delightful relationship. You know, that Buddy's theme, that's Buddy's theme in that piece. And I remember Jon and I were getting to know each other during Elf because he hadn't done anything of that scale, you know, yet.
Right.
And the rest of the history. But at that point, he had done Swingers and Maid, and this was a big new world for him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he took a leap of faith with me because I'd done a lot, I think, and we had a good meeting or two. And I remember sitting in this room, you know, I was searching for Buddy's theme, speaking of those themes that we try to find at night, late at night. Mm-hmm. And, I finally came across a little tune, you know, da 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 da, very simple. And I thought, you know, I played around with that for a day or so, a couple of days. And then for some reason, the idea of a whistler came into my head, how funny that might be if the choir, because we knew we were going to have a choir. We knew it was going to be a big score. And I thought, how funny to have all the singers whistling at one point. So what I came up with is I had my trusty music editor, Jeff Carson, who's one of my closest friends, and he's a great whistler. So I brought him into the studio and I had him whistle that tune. Mm. And so I mocked it up. I did a demo for John and we sat here and, you know, in a normal day of meetings, you know, I'll sit with a filmmaker and we'll play through a bunch of stuff I've written. And that scene came up because it's pretty early in the movie.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that quote unquote Buddy's theme would be needed. Mm-hmm. And I remember we watched it together, John and I and Jeff and maybe the editor, a couple other people. And John turned to me after that was done, when we get to New York, it ends. And he said, oh, son, Buddy's theme, something like that would be really cool. He thought that was temp music, it's a common mistake.
Yeah.
And I said, well, John, do you like it? Because I always preface it. Well, would you like that? And he goes, yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
And I go, well, guess what? That's Buddy's theme, I think. And I wrote that. He goes, that's you? I go, yeah. He goes, oh, that's cool. Let me hear that again.
Yeah.
So we play it again. Fun. And then, so it's like that with John. If I get to the right series of notes, John is boom. That's it. And he's very decisive. I love that about him.
Yeah.
The other part of it, of the stylistic changes, which you mentioned, you know, that particular scene and a lot of scenes like that are temped in by very skilled music editors. And so I think the audience may not know that sometimes the brilliance of a composer might be due to the fact that he or she had great music editors cutting scores together,
sure,
and making them sound like they were original compositions. So that one was cobbled together by our music editor, and there's a little Rankin and Bass in there.
Okay.
And there's a little, and then I think at the point where I knew it had to get big, I just took over and,
yeah,
you know, did my thing. But so there are a lot of hands in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, for me at least, it's not always just me coming up, and sometimes you're just copying a great temp.
Well, you know, to be fair, and to your credit, you still have to do the work. And, you know, I mean,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of composers out there that can hear a collection of, you know, really well-known music over the years and say, go do it without sounding like that. And that's one of the greatest challenges, I think, in modern music and film is, and it's a temp track driven issue, is, you know, satisfying what the intent of the director is by putting that temp music there, or the music editor, yeah, is putting the temp there to begin with. What's the intent, and how do you not sound like that and still retain your own voice? And that's no easy feat for anybody. And to your credit,
it is no easy feat. You're right. And I would just add that the hardest thing for me, and I think I've talked to other composers who feel the same way. Hardest thing is when they temp with your own music.
And then
you're like, I remember seeing a film many, many years ago that I was going to do, and they temped it with Liar Liar and Bruce Almighty.
Oh, geez.
And
yeah.
I was sort of taken aback because how do you try to outdo yourself? It was a weird thing. And so in that case, I ended up sort of copying myself, and the director was fine with that. So, you know, it just depends on who you're working with and you know, how you get to the finish line, really.
Well, let's pivot to something else from the same year, 2003.
Cool.
And I thought this would be an interesting thing to share because of what you shared with me not so long ago on this topic. And this is not a film that you wrote the entire score for, but I think it's one that meant a great deal to you. You know, Jerry Goldsmith was a friend to both of us, and his last film, Looney Tunes Back in Action, was one that you were called upon to provide some additional music. And I was hoping that you might be willing to share that very special story to you, because we, as we've talked about, we look up to Jerry in a godlike fashion. And it's a great story what you told me. So I hope you wouldn't mind recapitulating it here.
I don't mind at all. Gosh, I agree with you, Justin. To me, the two pillars are John and Jerry, you know, always will be in my lifetime.
Yes.
The Jerry story is interesting because I'd met John a number of times over the years, just being at Amblin and being with around Stephen, and, you know, and I would go say hi to John in the bungalow and all that. That's another story.
Yeah.
But Jerry, I had never met, you know, through all my years of working and all his years and all his amazing scores that he'd written, I'd never met him. So one day, my agent, Richard Kraft, called me. I was working on something here, and Richard called and he said, "Hey, I'm across the street at Warner Brothers. What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on whatever I was working on." And he said, "Do you want to come over and meet Jerry Goldsmith?" And I was like, "Pardon me? Yeah." And so I dropped everything, went across the street, and I got to watch Jerry. He was doing some of the music for Looney Tunes Back in Action. And I just was on the stage and standing and mesmerized and goosebumps. And Jerry wasn't feeling good right then. He was very, very ill, but he was on the podium. He was conducting, and watched a few cues, we call them, a few pieces of music. And then it was break time, and he came off the podium, and then Richard introduced me to Jerry. And it was first and only time I'd ever met him in person. And I said, "Oh my God, Maestro, what do you say when you're meeting God?" You know, I said, I think I was tongue tied. I said, "Oh my God, that last piece of music was so brilliant. I said, I don't know what to say. I'm just so pleased to meet you." And he said, "Eh," and he kind of blew it off. He blew it off.
Of course he did.
Yeah. James Horner wrote it better, you know, and his way of joking,
that's right.
He had a sort of a lifelong competitive thing with James.
Yeah.
And I think, like Richard Kraft has said many times, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but Richard had told me many times that he thought Jerry lasted a few extra years over his dislike of Mr. Horner. And it gave him a reason to get up and God bless you both up there, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, that's beside the point. So I met Jerry, spent a lovely couple hours over there, and came back and started working on my score, and just was thrilled and tickled to have met the man, and especially since I knew he was not feeling well and the prognosis wasn't good. So fade out, fade in. A few days later, Richard Kraft called me again, and he said, "You know, he said something very poignant to me. He said something like, you know, buddy, there are a few times in life where you can do something really special for someone." And I didn't know what he was going to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and he just, like he does, he just said, "Jerry wants you to finish the movie for him. Can you do it?" And I, of course, I start crying.
Wow.
And I said, "Of course." So I did. And, you know, we quickly apologize. I still tear up over it. Got the last reel or so, and met with Joe Dante and met everybody at Warner. And it was all love. And, you know, I just said, let's do this. And so I took Jerry's themes and just sort of, I was adept at that by then. I should back up and just say, Justin, as you well know, I did a lot of animation.
Yes.
And by then I'd done a lot with my friend Bruce Broughton.
Yep.
I'd done Tiny Toons and a lot of Disney animation over the years. So I was familiar with the beast that is animation. And I just dove in, and it was a joy. Never spoke to Jerry. Jerry was home. He had taken a turn for the worse. I finished the movie. I don't know. We probably did a couple more days of recording, and I finished the movie.
Disgusting earth rodent. Now to neutralize that duck.
Oh, this can't be good.
And it was like the honor of my lifetime. Fade out, fade in. Yeah. I don't know, about a month later. My wife told me, hey, something arrived for you. And it was a watch. Jerry had sent me a Cartier watch.
Oh, Jerry.
And
and
it meant so much to me that I could help him.
Yeah.
A moment of deep distress. And and he wrote me this little teeny note that said, hey, John, thanks a million. Your friend Jerry Goldsmith. And I was like, I have that. It's not framed, but I will someday. But every time I go to a, you know, if I ever win anything, Justin, I'm gonna wear the watch. And I've worn it a few times when I was up for something, be it an Emmy or whatever. And it gives me great joy. So somewhere along the line, if I ever win a prize for something, I'm gonna be wearing the watch with great pride.
That's a great story.
Yeah, and you know, that's the extent. And he was gone.
Yeah.
A month or so later, as you well know, he was gone shortly thereafter. I've had the unique opportunity to meet some of my heroes like that. I met Basil Poledouris.
Oh yeah, another great name.
On his last, we ended up in Spain together in a film music festival and concert, and I got to spend time with Basil, and we became fast friends. And he was like, it was a miracle what he accomplished that night. So I've been lucky to meet these heroes of mine, these titans of film music, you know, some before they've left. Yeah. And I'm really fortunate to be able to say that, but especially with Jerry and Basil.
Yeah.
You know, those were really special people to me that were very obviously influential on all of us. But especially me, because they're sort of my favorite.
Yeah, no, that's great.
And I got to meet two of them, and I got to meet James Horner, and I got to express my gratitude to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm lucky for that. I'm really lucky for that.
Yeah. So let's pivot to 2004, and you know, this is certainly a huge topic, given the content of the film. Maybe we can just
know where you're going.
If we can talk just briefly about what still all these years later, The Passion of the Christ means to you. And because certainly it was an iconic film, an iconic score, and the subject matter is one for the ages and has been. So, I mean, gosh, I can't even imagine how I'd approach something like that. I'm grateful that you were the one that did it. And
it was everything you can imagine. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I tell the story. I lost a bunch of weight while I was doing it. I've never been heavy, but it was such an inwardly difficult thing to pull out of my heart and soul. And Mel, you know, I love Mel. Mel is, you know, there are times he's the happiest guy on the planet. There are other times he's very, very low, as most great artists are, by the way. And we became like brothers, you know. He's done a bunch of war movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel like we're soldiers together in a foxhole. And that's the way The Passion was. It was deeply, you know, it was deep. Yeah. And I mean that in every way. It was, there were some days I had to just walk away. You know, I had to go and leave the studio and walk, you know, a couple of miles and then come back. And the visuals are so difficult to deal with.
Sure. You're right. It's visceral and
it's visceral.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it happens to be, I'm a Catholic boy from way back. So, you know, it's kind of all those things that that you think you know in grammar school and going to church and all that. And for me, I would crystallize it this way. My personal journey on that movie was, I was the Catholic boy, was an altar boy, gone through Catholic school, then kind of lost the faith, for a while there, and, lost my mom. I'd lost my dad many years ago. And then around 2001-ish, I think that's when my mom passed. Mm. And I was done. I was done with faith and religion, anything organized. I mean, I was always spiritual, but I just, I was done. And weirdly, you know, a couple of years after I lost my mom, I started reading. I don't know if somebody gave me a book about saints and, you know, St. Joseph and a little, a book about saints. And I remember starting to read it and starting to ponder it. And what that's how this started. What does faith mean? You know, and I mean that in a, like a religious sense. What is faith? Why? You know, people in those days get flogged and turned upside down and burned at the stake and, you know, and I just was asking why, you know. And so I was starting this kind of spiritual questioning and reawakening in my life. And then somewhere around 2003-ish, end of 2003-ish, I got a call one day from a friend of mine who was Mel Gibson's producer. Mm-hmm. He had produced many of Mel's films, Braveheart, bunch of Mel's films. Steve McAvity is his name, McAvity. And Steve called me one day and he goes, hey, what are you doing? I grew up on the same street as Steve. We were friends since childhood. And he called me one day and he said, hey, we got this film we're working on and we don't know what to do with the music. Would you look at it? And I said, sure. And then he started telling me and I started to get an inkling. Oh, is he talking about that movie that I've been reading about in the Inquirer, you know? And he goes, yeah, it's the, you know, it's called The Passion of the Christ. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I said, sure. He's a great friend of mine. I said, sure. Send it over. We'll watch it. My wife and I watched it. We're in tears, you know, many times during the, it's like, you know, very, very, very affecting movie. And when I saw it, it was much longer. So some of the more difficult scenes were
more difficult.
10 minutes longer than they were in the final film.
Yeah.
So I took a crazy leap of faith myself. And I told Steve, I go, it's deeply affecting, Steve. It's a very powerful film. And I said, look, I don't know. Let me write a few pieces of music. So that's what I did. I took the weekend or so, and I wrote about four or five pieces of music. Mm-hmm. And I called one, I don't know what I called them. I did one for the devil character, and I did one for an overall kind of a vibe, you know, with ethnic instruments and things like that. Anyway, long story short, I did those. I called upon some great friends of mine to come over, and yeah, Lizbeth Scott being one of them, our wonderful Lizbeth Scott, who's a wonderful vocalist, amazing vocalist and composer too. And we did some music, and I told Steve, I wrote some music. I don't know if you want me to send it over or whatever. And he goes, all right, well, let me tell Mel. I didn't hear back for a few days. Steve called and said, hey, Mel wants to come over and like hear what you got. I said, what? I'd never met Mel.
Sure.
And I go, what? He goes, yeah, he's going to come over. Is that cool? I go, sure. got off the phone and I told everybody here at work, and I said, guys, just letting you know, Mel Gibson's coming over.
Yeah.
And they didn't believe me. And I said, no, he's coming over. So Mel pulls up on his incredible Harley,
yeah,
you know, like a bat out of, you know what? And I heard that it comes up and, oh yeah, hi. Yeah, Mel Gibson. And mind you, I'd never met him and never talked to him in my life. Just Mel, not anybody else, comes over. I said, Mel, you know, let me just play you some stuff. I know this could all suck, but let me just play you stuff. He goes, yeah, let me hear what you got. So I played the music, and the one he responded to was a very, really percussive piece of music that was driving. And I kind of thought it might make a great trailer, you know, like a commercial,
sure,
or the film. And, you know, I played him everything I had done, and he was here about an hour or so. And he was like, you know, it was very noncommittal. He's like, you know. And then he said, let me hear that first one again. And the first one was this big percussive thing. And I saw him tapping his feet, and he's kind of bobbing his head. And it ended. It was like a 2-minute piece of music, big, big, powerful piece of music. And it ended, and he says, hey, well, thanks, you know, hey, really, really great stuff, you know, whatever. And great meeting you. And he ran out of here, and that was it. And I thought, hey, if nothing else, I get to meet Mel Gibson.
Yeah,
really,
right.
Cool.
Yeah.
And I called Steve. I go, Steve, I have no idea if you liked it or not. And Steve said, oh, well, yeah, let me talk to him, you know, both. Didn't hear anything. For days, you know, many days, maybe 5 days or something. And then Steve called me out of the blue one day. He goes, hey, Mel really, really liked what he heard. He wants you to do this thing, you know. And it was like that. It was very matter of fact, like that.
Yeah, that's great.
And I know this is a little bit of a long-winded story, but that then started this journey.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Highs, lows. Experimenting with Mel almost every few days. We'd bring in musicians. We'd try things. I'd keep him very caffeinated, lots of good coffee. And we had a ball. We, you know, it was work. You know what I mean? It was like Mel works. And it wasn't a lot of pleasantries. It was sort of come in, we work. And if he was happy, he was really happy. And if he was not so sure, then he was not so sure. One of my favorite stories of many was one day he came in. We were trying to get a sound for those that have seen the movie. There's a powerful scene where Judas commits suicide and he hangs himself. And we tried singer after singer after singer. I'd bring in singers of different types. And we couldn't get it. And one day Mel came in and he was sick. He had a cold. And I said, Mel, what? I said, would you try it for me? Would you just try a wail? I wanted a wail. I wanted some kind of he's very musical. So Mel can sing and he's got this amazing range in his voice, really low, go very high. And so I put him in the booth here. I hung a mic up. We had the scene on the screen. And let me tell you, Justin, what came out of that man was perfect, otherworldly, this wail of just incredible pain and otherworldly pain.
Thank you.
you know, he did it a few times, but really I used the first one he did. And he came in, he goes, is that okay? And I go, is that okay? It's incredible. And we played it for him. He was like, yeah, you like it. Okay. That's, you know, that's the way Mel is. He's like, okay, yeah. All right, if you like it, that's
yeah,
cool.
Next. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so yeah. It was like that. It was like yeah. a journey. It was just a process of yeah. discovery
yeah.
every day.
Yeah.
Every day. So.
Yeah. Well, that's,
and I could go on and on. I'll write the book someday. But,
yeah, well, you know you talk about journey and process. You know, that's such a great deal of the craft. You know, as you're married to film, and yeah. you don't often discover what you need to discover until you're kind of all the way through the looking glass. But
well, that's true. And the one thing I would tell you about that score, which was so interesting in hindsight, and this is the last story that I'll bore you with. But that score is really different for me than anything yep. I've done, obviously. I mean, yeah. you can listen to it and it's all over the place, hopefully in a good way. But that score starts in a very amorphous fashion. Mm-hmm. It's like we're in the garden and it's misty and at night and you can't really see much, and the music starts with a pad, and then there's another sound, and then there's a vocal. And then it goes from there. And the interesting thing about that score is it starts from nothing
mm-hmm.
and then transforms through the movie into this incredibly traditional, almost gothic score.
Yeah.
And we didn't plan it that way. Huh. We did not plan it that way.
That's interesting.
It just was, the film spoke to us, and Mel, to his credit, there were times when I think he would have preferred most of the score to be more sort of avant-garde mm-hmm. and contemporary. But as it developed, and especially when there's a very, very powerful piece of music when they yeah. you know, they nailed Jesus to the cross. And yeah. I said, how can I not write for the orchestra and write for the choir,
right.
especially? And to Mel's credit, you know, he heard it and he went, wow. And he went along with it. And I thought I was going to have to be doing drones for the whole end of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's what really, it was one of many things that impressed me about Mel, is that when he knew it was right, he went with it. Mm-hmm. And I think all great filmmakers do that, from Jon Favreau to
yeah.
Mel to others. They kind of know when it's working, and it may not yeah. be what they first thought it should be, but they're collaborative mm-hmm. and yeah. that's the great thing, you know,
yeah.
and Mel was that way, you know, and it just became cool and fun. And we go in over to London, and I had Mel playing drums on the resurrection. I mean, we just really, we put our heart and souls into it. And I think really proud of it, you know,
yeah.
just for what we accomplished.
Well, you can hear the quality
of the score, you know?
Yeah. I mean, all these years later, you can still kind of hear that journey that you took on it. And it's one that will be with us for many, 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 many years. So.
Brought to you by Cineconcerts.